Thanks for joining us on the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Marcus Matthews. He's the resident bishop of the United Methodist Church's Upper New York area. He's also on the board of directors of Africa University in Zimbabwe, which is affiliated with the church. Bishop Matthews, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your current position in the church. We'll get to Africa University a bit later, but first, can you tell me what being the resident bishop for the Upper New York area means?
Yes. June 19, 2010, what we had happened in this Upper New York area was four annual conferences came together. We have now 182,000 members. We're divided into 12 districts, which is really 12 different geographical areas. And we cover the major urban areas of Buffalo, Syracuse, Binghamton, and Albany, some 42,000 square miles. And it's a privilege being resident bishop of this area, which has a lot of diversity. Because of the variety of people who are part of this fellowship.
And resident bishop, then you're essentially the administrative leader of this area that we're talking about?
Correct. I have a cabinet, and that cabinet is made of 12 district superintendents who have oversight for the 900-plus clergy, and we have what we call executive staff, who are the persons that help to put together the programmatic and administrative life of the annual conference. And so those persons helped to assist me in my ministry here.
And you mentioned the 182,000 members in your particular area. My understanding is that the Methodists are the third largest Christian denomination in the country. Have there been any recent trends in your membership, both in this area or more nationally?
Yes. Let me just say, in the U.S., because we are a global church,
right.
We have churches all over the world. In the U.S., over the last 40 years, we really have not been growing at the level in which we would want. Our growth has been taking place outside the United States, mainly in Africa and Latin America.
And what's the attraction for folks in Africa and Latin America to Methodism? Is it something about your social message, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination of United Methodists tend to be persons who practice two type of holiness, personal and social. And I think it's that bringing those two together, I think that's attractive there. I think also we have put a lot of emphasis in Africa around leadership development. If you look at the continent of Africa, many of the political leaders, many of the governmental leaders are persons who have studied in either our boarding schools or other institutions. And so we have a pretty good track record, at least on the continent of Africa, in terms of mission work that we have been doing over the years. And so I think that helps first persons to be attracted to our churches, to our denomination.
I want to get into some of the social aspects of the church in a little bit, but let me come back to this other question, and this may be a tough one for you to answer, but how would you describe where the Methodist Church sits culturally within Christianity? I don't know if there is perhaps an axis you could put this along and say, you know, the Catholics are here, we're here, but anything that you could tell me that would help me get a sense of where you guys sit.
Right. Let me just say, we are a denomination, I believe, that offers people an opportunity to be engaged in conversation. We take seriously what we call holy conferencing, that when we gather with persons trying to get a variety of input. We tend to be a denomination, I guess if you were to look at a scale of 0 to 5, we would be probably middle of the road. We tend to have persons in our denomination who are very conservative. We have persons very liberal. I always like to use the illustration of a church, which is one of our large churches in the nation's capital, Foundry. Most of my ministry, as you know, has been in the Washington, D.C. area, where I spent some 30-plus years. Foundry was one of those churches that I spent a lot of time working with. On a given Sunday, you could have the Clintons sitting on one pew and the Bob Dole on another pew. And so that's kind of who we are as United Methodists. We have the Clintons. We have the George Bush. We are a denomination where we say that there's room enough for all of us to come at the table to have conversation and to decide where God is moving us in terms of our mission and ministry.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the Methodist Bishop Marcus Matthews. Well, in a news report from when you assumed the leadership of the upper New York area, you said something that intrigued me, and it brings me back to this social component I wanted to talk to you about. You talked about the need to move people in the church out into the community to witness and share the joy people have experienced as Methodists. Mm-hmm. But I think these days a lot of people are questioning the effect that taking the church into the community is having, particularly if we think about our political life. So I wanted to ask you this broad question first. How do you think religion and politics are mixing at the moment?
Let me just say that it's very hard during the time in which we live to make sure that there is a clear difference. I was just reminded, I was at a meeting last week, and the speaker was Congressman Clyburn from South Carolina, as you know, who is third in terms of the Democratic Party. And he spoke about a situation in which I will not name one of the Republican presidential candidates was in a religious gathering, and that the group did not endorse him per se, but what they decided to do at the end of the meeting, they invited him to come forward and they laid their hands on him. I think there are different ways in which the religious community is sending signals to its members about where we want people to be involved. And that's just one illustration of how I think there's kind of a crossing over back and forth, not getting up in the pulpit and saying, we want you to vote this way or vote for this person, but finding, I think, rather clever, sophisticated ways now of doing that.
But I wanted to follow up on this and push you a little bit more on it. And again, to think about the church as an institution that frames people's activities in the community. And it's one thing to organize church members to do good works outside the church, you know, to volunteer, to help out in different ways. But I do want to ask, how do you, though, really take people into the community carrying the message of the church without creating some of these political tensions that we've seen, either from the right or, I think, arguably less frequently, from the left? How does that get played out?
Yeah. Let me just say, at the end of the day, what is required of all of us is that we try to live out those moral imperatives that we understand that the gospel is informing us to do. What I strongly say to our clergy and to the laity is that people are not interested in hearing a sermon from us per se in the neighborhood, but they're interested in seeing how we live out those things that we really say we believe. For an example, if we really say that we believe in helping the poor, then how are we really living that out 24/7 without necessarily hitting a person over the head and saying that I represent this denomination, do this, join this church? But how do we help people to see that those things that we really believe, that we are living them out 24/7 in our neighborhoods? How do we then welcome persons who are different from us into our churches, into our fellowship? I think first we do have to go out into the neighborhood because we need to know where the needs are. And there are a lot of people out here hurting, and it's not always easy. is not always easy because, unfortunately, the church, to a large extent, has become very comfortable staying within those four walls. And so our challenge, at least of United Methodists in this area, is to go out and to be with the people and to interact and to find out where we can be of help and where we can work in partnership together so that it's not the church coming in being the big savior, but that we work in partnership with people and institutions.
I think politics certainly has had an effect on your own religious journey, as I understand the story. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I grew up in South Carolina, and it was a local church that understood that its role was to not only nurture us in the faith, but to also be a bridge as a witness to that particular community, because I grew up during a period in which segregation was coming to an end. So the church then, as I saw it growing up, became very involved with the politics of that city. It became the voice for those who didn't have a voice at the city council table. And so some people will say that was crossing the line. That may have been true. But the church was being a prophetic witness for those who did not have a voice. And so I have seen that throughout all of my life, that the church does have to be a voice for those who do not have a voice in certain arenas. Though we do try to make sure we keep things separate, but there comes a moment in, depending upon what community you're dealing with, wherein that the church does have to take on a different role.
And you were involved in a important historical moment in the civil rights movement.
Yes.
There in your town. And my understanding is that it sparked your interest in religion. Maybe I've got that wrong, but tell me about that.
Yes, that was February of 1968, February 4, 1968, which is known by some as the day of the Orangeburg Massacre. I was a college student at the time at South Carolina State University. What had happened, there were a number of events leading up to that date. There were demonstrations trying to get into a variety of places, eating facilities. But what was the target, what turned the time was a bowling alley. Several students had gone to this bowling alley. They were denied entrance. Students began to go back and try to get into the bowling alley. Finally, it ended up with over 200 of us on one night gathering on the campus about to go to that very same bowling alley when the South Carolina State Highway Patrol, who were along the outskirts of the campus, fired on the students. That night, three students were killed, and about 27 were shot in the back or in the because we were on the ground crawling in the dirt trying to get back into a safe space on the campus. But that, yes, that did trigger a lot in my head. Up until that point, I was positioned to graduate and to go into grad school because I had some ideas about majoring in sociology and getting maybe a master's in something else later. But it was during that moment that I realized that God was, that God had spared my life for something more than just simply thinking about myself. Because I must admit, up until that point, it was all what was for me. And so I began thinking, what could I do then to help persons? And what could I do to help change institutions? And what could I do to make a difference with situations like what I was experiencing so that history would not repeat itself later?
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Methodist Bishop Marcus Matthews. Well, I want to change gears a bit here and ask you before we get to the questions at the end, About 7 years ago, your denomination was at the center of an ongoing controversy in all of organized religion about the role that openly gay people can and should play as ministers. And in Pennsylvania, Beth Stroud was defrocked as a Methodist minister for being openly gay. That decision was overturned by an appeals panel, but then as a bishop in the Philadelphia Episcopal area, you appealed that decision to the highest body, the Judicial Council, which made the final decision to defrock her. And as I said, other denominations have been confronting this, and some have changed their policy. So I wanted to ask you, where is the Methodist Church on this issue at present?
Let me just say, we have been dealing with this issue as a denomination since 1972, and we will be dealing with it again when we gather in April in Tampa, Florida. There have been some developments. There have been some changes. One of the things that we are very, very clear on is that all of our churches are open to all people. We do not deny anyone access to our worship, to our activities. Our churches are open to all. Even our communion table is open to all. With the Beth Stroud case, I was the resident bishop of the Eastern Pennsylvania Conference. I actually was assigned to that area when the trial and the process had been put in place. And so I had to make sure that it was carried forth. The joy that I experienced, if there was any joy in this situation, it was in personally meeting with Beth Stroud and trying to be pastoral to her in the midst of a trial, which trials no one wins, as we all know. I found her to, in that setting, to have been a person of high integrity. I found her to be open and willing to at least work with the process. As a denomination, we are not of one accord on this issue. We are divided as a family. We are divided as a family. We try to continue to work toward, though, unity, but on this issue, presently, we remain still divided. We do have pastors who are gay. We do have pastors who are gay. The issue in our denomination is that in terms of the marriage and use of facilities, our denomination has not given permission for our pastors to perform same-sex marriages. And nor has our denomination given permission for our facilities, our buildings, to be used for that purpose. That is part of
the conversation.
The conversation that will continue.
But let me get to Africa University too. You're the vice chair of the board of trustees of that institution, and I understand that you were also involved in its founding by the church 20 years ago. We talked about Africa and Latin America before. Could you just tell me briefly about the vision of the university and the story behind its founding?
Mm-hmm. The General Conference, which is the only group that can speak for our denomination, in 1988, Grant gave approval for this institution to take place. It is located in Mutare, Zimbabwe. You may want to ask the question, why Zimbabwe, knowing some of the political things that are happening there? If you look back in 1988, Zimbabwe was neck and neck with, say, South Africa. It was one of the premier countries on the continent. And all the projections at that time indicated that that was one of the best places for it. Also, Bishop Hartzell, who was one of our bishops, had a vision. He helped to get the land for the university. And Bishop Hartzell, as he saw Zimbabwe back over 100 years ago, saw children walking on that property with books, and he saw that there was a need for education to take place there. And so that's how we came up with that site in Mutare. Let me just say, the university was set up to be a pan-African university. Our goal is to have 60% of the students who attend that university come from other parts of the continent other than Zimbabwe. One of the results that we are beginning to see, we have over 3,000 now graduates who are basically, I would say 98% of them stay on the continent of Africa. They are working in government and other strategic places. We believe that if there's going to be peace on the continent of Africa, a lot of that's going to be because these students are studying at African University. When they go back to their homes, they go back looking differently at the people, say, from a different country on the continent. And we believe that that will bring about some peace because of that.
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Over the last 3 years, I have been probably institutional building, which is has been a challenge for me because I like to be more pastoral, more hands-on.
Second, what's your worst trait?
That we will not, as an annual conference, appreciate the diversity and also acknowledge that we disagree on some issues, but that we find a way to agree to disagree.
And third, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
That I have ended up here in Syracuse. And I'll say very quickly because when I graduated from college, I received a Ford Foundation Fellowship, which gave me an opportunity to study religious institutions for a year. For some unknown reason, I selected Syracuse, and I wanted to study the how churches had an impact upon the court system with youth. And so I spent 3 months here in Syracuse in the early 70s doing that kind of work. I had no idea then that I would return here in later life as a resident bishop of this area.
That was Bishop Marcus Matthews. Bishop Matthews, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.